June 15, 2002. Why Bother Reading Thomas Hardy? By Mike Eshman, aka Trout. Good morning. Sitting in class today, you might ask, what does this have to do with me? It might seem as if some great machine was trying to mill you, as if you were a piece of wood. Well, as you get older, that feeling grows. Did you see that movie, The Matrix? In that movie, all of us are being used as fuel for machines. That's right, the machines put us into their gas pumps. We power their radios and automobiles. We live to light libraries used by machines. Humans don't count for anything anymore, but some still dream. In The Matrix, when you wake up to see where you really spend your days, that's a feeling that resonates. It is a flaw of nature in us, this instinct that has us look back to see where we have come from. It is an easy thing to wallow in close friendships or rally to a cause to find some peace of mind away from that awful feeling of being the one among too many and too much. But you are not alone, and you must be alone to come to terms with the we, the us, and the I. Many have come before you, and they lay these trials, these thoughts and memories, onto paper. Why? Perhaps to scratch an itch, without a thought for those who follow. What difference does that make? In reading the past, you go into a place the author doesn't know, but you know. A place you know, but haven't been. And in that place, the subtle chemistry of acceptance and renewal and the other countless unnameables get put for use some later date. So that a red book is like a coin in your pocket. Decades after leaving school behind me, I found myself away from home, alone, working in an office that could have been anywhere and doing things that might have been done by anyone. Alone, in a bare apartment at night. There was the television, walking up to the store for food, a bar, not much of anything. Every so many weekends, you get to drive, or fly, back into your life. Children, the girls, Kristen, and Melissa. A wife, Charlotte. Dinner, and bedtime. Home. It was DC, so the opportunity to see, and do, art, and history. To indulge reflections on the past, these become a weekend away from the cares of daily life. The museums, the Smithsonian, they provide a glimpse into a collective mind. But only books can offer those comforts on the subway or at lunch. Sitting in a gray cloth box among a field of other gray cloth boxes, Hemingway takes you, you go trout fishing. He feeds you bacon, he pours you a third or fourth drink, in a world that counts companions by ones and twos instead of hundreds or millions. In A Movable Feast, Ernest tells you where it came from, the almost magical ability to transport a reader into a field, to smell the smells and feel the coolness of the damp on the flannel sleeve. That exists only in your mind. He says it came from reading Thomas Hardy. The Interlopers is a story of marriage, the lap of long habit, families, rather than an individual soul. For the soul is a private thing, a thing that expresses itself at right angles to its intent. Not like it is now. Not like us. There is no TV, no radio, no phone. If a newspaper is available, it is weeks old, brought to town as a keepsake of a visit to somewhere else. There is no need to plan the future. As long as life goes on, the character of tomorrow is known, even as the sun shines down on today. Tomorrow grows warm in the same light that warms today. What did that mean? Well, at one time we lived in Florida, and, on occasion, we would drive to Grassy Key, down at the very bottom of the state. In that place, at least back then, it moved slowly. No one was in the keys to move quickly. And the sea and sky were a single canvas, they were the same, and one just leaked into the other. On a good day, you would wake, and it would still be yesterday. On a good week, time lost all meaning. Before machines, people lived that way. The people in the interlopers, they live that way, without clocks. People are known to each other, they carry no mystery, no flaw lurks. For all those parts are kept tucked away, where no hand may reach, to touch. Into that world, inject a son, and brother, back from Australia and penniless, sick, and with a family of his own, stuck into the night of a wedding party. Mix in former lovers, death, unspoken intentions. Now, you're in the interlopers. This drama plays out on an immovable earth. People are minor details, landscaping, almost like ants. Is that what they meant by God-fearing people back in Hardy's time and place? Or, at least, is that what he and his readers had agreed among themselves? Enjoy the story. Wessex Tales, Interlopers at the Knap, full text. Another Thomas Hardy masterpiece. April, 1880. Interlopers at the Knap. Chapter 1. The north road from Casterbridge is tedious and lonely, especially in winter time. Along a part of its course it connects with Long Ash Lane, a monotonous track, without a village or hamlet, for many miles, and with very seldom a turning. Unapprised wayfarers, who are too old, or too young, or in other respects, too weak, for the distance to be traversed, but who, nevertheless, have to walk it, say, as they look wistfully ahead. Once at the top of that hill, and I must surely see the end of Long Ash Lane. But they reach the hilltop, and Long Ash Lane stretches in front as mercilessly as before. Some few years ago, a certain farmer was riding through this lane in the gloom of a winter evening. The farmer's friend, a dairyman, was riding beside him. A few paces in the rear rode the farmer's man. All three were well-horsed, on strong, round-barreled cobs, and to be well-horsed was to be in better spirits about Long Ash Lane than poor pedestrians could attain to during its passage. But the farmer did not talk much to his friend as he rode along. The enterprise which had brought him there filled his mind, for in truth, it was important. Not altogether so important was it, perhaps, when estimated by its value to society at large. But, if the true measure of a deed be proportionate to the space it occupies in the heart of him who undertakes it, Farmer Charles Darton's business tonight could hold its own with the business of kings. He was a large farmer. His turnover, as it is called, was probably £30,000 a year. He had a great many draft horses, a great many milch cows, and of sheep, a multitude. This comfortable position was, however, none of his own making. It had been created by his father, a man of a very different stamp from the present representative of the line. Darton, the father, had been a one-ideaed character, with a buttoned-up pocket, and a chink-like eye, brimming with commercial subtlety. In Darton the son, this trade subtlety had become transmuted into emotional, and the harshness had disappeared. He would have been called a sad man, but for his constant care not to divide himself from lively friends by piping notes out of harmony with theirs. Contemplative, he allowed his mind to be a quiet meeting place for memories and hopes. So that, naturally enough, since succeeding to the agricultural calling, and, up to his present age of 32, he had neither advanced nor receded as a capitalist. A stationary result, which did not agitate one, of his unambitious, unstrategic nature, since he had all that he desired. The motive of his expedition tonight showed the same absence of anxious regard for number one. The party rode on in the slow, safe trot, proper to nighttime and bad roads, Farmer Darton's head jigging rather unromantically up and down against the sky, and his motions being repeated, with bolder emphasis, by his friend Japheth Johns, while those of the latter were travestied, and jerks still less softened by art, in the person of the lad who attended them. A pair of whitish objects hung, one on each side of the ladder, bumping against him at each step, and, still further spoiling the grace of his seat. On close inspection, they might have been perceived to be open rush baskets, one containing a turkey, and the other, some bottles of wine. "Do you feel ye can meet your fate like a man, neighbor Darton?" asked Johns, breaking a silence which had lasted while 25 hedgerow trees had glided by. Mr. Darton, with a half laugh, murmured, "A call it my fate. Hanging and wiving go by destiny." And then they were silent again. The darkness thickened rapidly, at intervals shutting down on the land, in a perceptible flap, like the wave of a wing. The customary close of day was accelerated by a simultaneous blurring of the air. With the fall of night had come a mist, just damp enough to incommode, but not sufficient to saturate them. Countrymen as they were born, as may be said, with only an open door between them and the four seasons, they regarded the mist but as an added obscuration, and ignored its humid quality. They were traveling in a direction that was enlivened by no modern current of traffic, the place of Darton's pilgrimage being an old-fashioned village, one of the Hintocks. Several villages of that name, with a distinctive prefix or affix, lying thereabout, where the people make the best cider and cider wine in all Wessex, and where the dunghill smell of pomace instead of stable refuse, as elsewhere. The lane was sometimes so narrow that the brambles of the hedge, which hung forward like anglers' rods over a stream, scratched their hats and curry-combed their whiskers as they passed. Yet, this neglected lane had been a highway to Queen Elizabeth's subjects and the cavalcades of the past. Its day was over now, and its history as a national artery, done forever. "Why, I have decided to marry her," resumed Darton, in a measured musical voice of confidence, which revealed a good deal of his composition, as he glanced round to see that the lad was not too near, "is not only that I like her, but that I can do no better, even from a fairly practical point of view. That I might all look higher is possibly true, though it is really all nonsense. I have had experience enough in looking above me. No more superior women for me," said I you know when. "Sally is a comely, independent, simple character, with no makeup about her, who will think me as much a superior to her as I used to think you know who, I mean, was to me." "Eh," said Johns. "However, I shouldn't call Sally all simple. Primary, because no Sally is. Secondary, because if some could be, this one wouldn't. 'Tis a wrong denomination to apply to a woman, Charles, and affects me as your best man, like cold water. 'Tis like recommending a stage play by saying there's neither murder, villainy, nor harm of any sort in it, when that's what you've paid your half-crown to see. Well, may your opinion do you good. Mine's a different one." And turning the conversation from the philosophical to the practical, Darton expressed a hope that the said Sally had received what he'd sent on by the carrier that day. Johns wanted to know what that was. It is a dress, said Darton. Not exactly a wedding dress, though she may use it as one, if she likes. It is rather serviceable than showy, suitable for the winter weather. Good, said Johns. Serviceable is a wise word in a bridegroom. I commend thee, Charles. For, said Darton, why should a woman dress up like a rope dancer, because she's going to do the most solemn deed of her life, except dying? Faith, why? But she will, because she will, I suppose, said Dairyman Johns. H'M, said Darton. The lane they followed had been nearly straight for several miles, but it now took a turn, unwinding uncertainly for some distance, forked into two. By night, country roads are apt to reveal ungainly qualities, which pass without observation during day, and though Darton had traveled this way before, he had not done so frequently, Sally having been wooed at the house of a relative, near his own. He never remembered seeing, at this spot, a pair of alternative ways looking so equally probable, as these two did now. Johns rode on a few steps. Don't be out of heart, sonny, he cried. Here's a hand post. Enoch, come and climb this post, and tell us the way. The lad dismounted, and jumped into the hedge, where the post stood under a tree. Unstrap the baskets, or you will smash up that wine, cried Darton, as the young man began spasmodically to climb the post, baskets and all. Was there ever less head in a brainless world, said Johns. Here, simple knocky, I'll do it. He leapt off, and with much puffing climbed the post, striking a match when he reached the top, and moving the light along the arm, the lad standing, and gazing at the spectacle. I have faced tantalization these 20 years, with a temper as mild as milk, said Japheth. But such things as this don't come short of devilry. And flinging the match away, he slipped down to the ground. What's the matter? Asked Darton. Not a letter, sacred or heathen, not so much as would tell us the way to the great fireplace, ever I should sin to say it. Either the moss and mildew have eat away the words, or we have arrived in a land where the natives have lost the art of writing, and should have brought our compass, like Christopher Columbus. Let us take the straightest road, said Darton placidly. I shan't be sorry to get there, 'tis a tiresome ride. I would have driven, if I had known. Nor I neither, sir, said Enoch. These straps plow my shoulder like a zull. If 'tis much further to your lady's home, Maester Darton, I shall ask to be let carry half of these good things, in my innards, he. Don't you be such a reforming radical, Enoch, said John sternly. Here, I'll take the turkey. This being done, they went forward by the right-hand lane, which ascended a hill, the left winding away under a plantation. The pit-a-pat of their horses' hoofs lessened up the slope, and the ironical directing post stood in solitude as before, holding out its blank arms to the raw breeze, which brought a snore from the wood, as if Skrimmer the giant were sleeping there. Chapter 2. 3 miles to the left of the travelers, along the road they had not followed, rose an old house, with mullioned windows of Ham Hill stone, and chimneys of lavish solidity. It stood at the top of a slope, beside King's Hintock Village Street, and immediately in front of it, grew a large sycamore tree, whose bared roots formed a convenient staircase, from the road below, to the front door of the dwelling. Its situation gave the house what little distinctive name it possessed, namely, the Knap. Some 40 yards off, a brook dribbled past, which, for its size, made a great deal of noise. At the back was a dairy barton, accessible for vehicles and livestock, by a side drawn. Thus much only of the character of the homestead could be divined out of doors, at this shady evening time. But, within there was plenty of light to see by, as plenty was construed a tintock. Beside a Tudor fireplace, whose molded four-centered arch was nearly hidden by a figured blue cloth blower, were seated two women, mother and daughter, Mrs. Hall, and Sarah, or Sally, for this was a part of the world where the latter modification had not as yet been effaced, as a vulgarity, by the march of intellect. The owner of the name was the young woman by whose means Mr. Darton proposed to put an end to his bachelor condition on the approaching day. The mother's bereavement had been so long ago as not to leave much mark of its occurrence upon her now, either in face or clothes. She had resumed the mob cap of her early married life, enlivening its whiteness by a few rose dewberry ribbons. Sally required no such aids to pinkness. Roseate good nature lit up her gaze, her features showed curves of decision and judgment, and she might have been regarded, without much mistake, as a warm-hearted, quick-spirited, handsome girl. She did most of the talking, her mother listening with a half-absent air, as she picked up fragments of red-hot wood ember with the tongs, and piled them upon the brands. But the number of speeches that passed was very small in proportion to the meanings exchanged. Long experience together often enabled them to see the course of thought in each other's minds without a word being spoken. Behind them, in the center of the room, the table was spread for supper, certain whiffs of air laden with fat vapors, which ever and anon entered from the kitchen, denoting its preparation there. The new gown he was going to send you stays about on the way like himself, Sally's mother was saying. Yes, not finished, I dare say, cried Sally independently. Lord, I shouldn't be amazed if it didn't come at all. Young men make such kind promises when they are near you and forget them when they go away. But he doesn't intend it as a wedding gown. He gives it to me merely as a gown to wear when I like. A traveling dress is what it would be called by some. Come wraith or come late, it don't much matter, as I have a dress of my own to fall back upon. But what time is it? She went to the family clock and opened the glass, for the hour was not otherwise discernible by night, and, indeed, at all times, was rather a thing to be investigated than beheld, so much more wall than window was there in the apartment. It is nearly 8, said she. 8 o'clock, and neither dress nor man, said Mrs. Hall. Mother, if you think to tantalize me by talking like that, you are much mistaken. Let him be as late as he will, or stay away altogether, I don't care, said Sally. But a tender, minute quaver in the negation showed that there was something forced in that statement. Mrs. Hall perceived it, and dryly observed that she was not so sure about Sally not caring. But perhaps you don't care so much as I do, after all, she said. For I see what you don't, that it is a good and flourishing match for you, a very honorable offer in Mr. Darton. And I think I see a kind husband in him. So pray God 'twill go smooth and wind up well. Sally would not listen to misgivings. Of course it would go smoothly, she asserted. How you are up and down, mother, she went on. At this moment, whatever hinders him, we are not so anxious to see him as he is to be here, and his thought runs on before him and settles down upon us like the star in the east. Hark, she exclaimed, with a breath of relief, her eyes sparkling. I heard something. Yes, here they are. The next moment her mother's slower ear also distinguished the familiar reverberation occasioned by footsteps clambering up the roots of the sycamore. Yes, it sounds like them at last, she said. Well, it is not so very late after all, considering the distance. The footfall ceased, and they arose, expecting a knock. They began to think it might have been, after all, some neighboring villager under Bacchic influence, giving the center of the road a wide berth, when their doubts were dispelled by the newcomer's entry into the passage. The door of the room was gently opened, and there appeared, not the pair of travelers with whom we have already made acquaintance, but a pale-faced man, in the garb of extreme poverty, almost in rags. "Oh, it's a tramp, gracious me," said Sally, starting back. His cheeks and eye orbits were deep concaves, rather, it might be, from natural weakness of constitution than irregular living, though there were indications that he had led no careful life. He gazed at the two women fixedly for a moment, then with an abashed, humiliated demeanor, dropped his glance to the floor, and sank into a chair, without uttering a word. Sally was in advance of her mother, who had remained standing by the fire. She now tried to discern the visitor, across the candles. "Why, mother," said Sally faintly, turning back to Mrs. Hall. "It is Phil, from Australia." Mrs. Hall started, and grew pale, and a fit of coughing seized the man with the ragged clothes. "To come home like this," she said. "Oh, Philip, are you ill?" "No, no, mother," replied he impatiently, as soon as he could speak. "But for God's sake, how do you come here, and just now too?" "Well, I am here," said the man. "How it is, I hardly know. I've come home, mother, because I was driven to it. Things were against me out there, and went from bad to worse." "Then why didn't you let us know? You've not read a line for the last 2 or 3 years." The son admitted sadly that he had not. He said that he had hoped, and thought he might fetch up again, and be able to send good news. Then he had been obliged to abandon that hope, and had finally come home from sheer necessity, previously, to making a new start. "Yes, things are very bad with me," he repeated, perceiving their commiserating glances at his clothes. They brought him nearer the fire, took his hat from his thin hand, which was so small and smooth, as to show that his attempts to fetch up again had not been in a manual direction. His mother resumed her inquiries, and dubiously asked if he had chosen to come that particular night, for any special reason. For no reason, he told her. His arrival had been quite at random. Then Philip Hall looked round the room, and saw for the first time that the table was laid somewhat luxuriously, and for a larger number than themselves, and that an air of festivity pervaded their dress. He asked quickly what was going on. "Sally is going to be married in a day or two," replied the mother, and she explained how Mr. Darton, Sally's intended husband, was coming there that night with the groomsman, Mr. Johns, and other details. "We thought it must be their step when we heard you," said Mrs. Hall. The needy wanderer looked again on the floor. I see," he murmured. "Why, indeed, should I have come tonight? Such folk as I are not wanted here at these times, naturally. And I have no business here, spoiling other people's happiness." "Phil," said his mother, with a tear in her eye, but with a thinness of lip and severity of manner which were presumably not more than past events justified, "since you speak like that to me, I'll speak honestly to you. For these 3 years, you have taken no thought for us. You left home with a good supply of money, and strength and education, and you ought to have made good use of it all. But you come back like a beggar, and that you come in a very awkward time for us, cannot be denied. Your return tonight may do us much harm. But mind, you are welcome to this home, as long as it is mine. I don't wish to turn you adrift. We will make the best of a bad job, and I hope you are not seriously ill." "Oh no, I have only this infernal cough." She looked at him anxiously. I think you had better go to bed at once, she said. Well, I shall be out of the way there, said the sun wearily. Having ruined myself, don't let me ruin you by being seen in these togs, for heaven's sake. Who do you say Sally is going to be married? To a farmer Darton. Yes, a gentleman farmer, quite a wealthy man. Far better in station than she could have expected. It is a good thing, altogether. Well done, little Sal, said her brother, brightening, and looking up at her with a smile. I ought to have written, but perhaps I have thought of you, all the more. But let me get out of sight. I would rather go, and jump into the river, than be seen here. But have you anything I can drink? I am confoundedly thirsty, with my long tramp. Yes, yes, we will bring something upstairs to you, said Sally, with grief in her face. Eh, that will do nicely. But, Sally and mother apostrophe he stopped, and they waited. Mother, I have not told you all, he resumed slowly, still looking on the floor, between his knees. Sad as what you see of me is, there's worse behind. His mother gazed upon him, in grieved suspense, and Sally went, and leant upon the bureau, listening for every sound, and sighing. Suddenly she turned round, saying, let them come, I don't care. Philip, tell the worst, and take your time. Well then, said the unhappy Phil, I am not the only one, in this mess. Would to heaven I were. But apostrophe O, Phil. I have a wife, as destitute as I. A wife, said his mother. Unhappily. A wife. Yes, that is the way with sons. And besides apostrophe said he. Besides. Oh, Philip, surely apostrophe I have two little children. Wife and children, whispered Mrs. Hall, sinking down confounded. Poor little things, said Sally involuntarily. His mother turned again to him. I suppose these helpless beings are left in Australia? No. They are in England. Well, I can only hope you've left them in a respectable place. I have not left them at all. They are here within a few yards of us. In short, they are in the stable. Where? In the stable. I did not like to bring them indoors, till I had seen you, mother, and broken the bad news, a bit to you. They were very tired, and are resting out there, on some straw. Mrs. Hall's fortitude visibly broke down. She had been brought up, not without refinement, and was even more moved, by such a collapse of genteel aims as this, than a substantial dairyman's widow would in ordinary have been moved. Well, it must be borne, she said, in a low voice, with her hands tightly joined. A starving son, a starving wife, starving children. Let it be. But, why is this come to us now, today, tonight? Could no other misfortune happen to helpless women than this, which will quite upset my poor girl's chance of a happy life? Why have you done us this wrong, Philip? What respectable man will come here, and marry open-eyed, into a family of vagabonds? Nonsense, mother, said Sally vehemently, while her face flushed. Charlie isn't the man to desert me. But if he should be, and won't marry me because Phil's come, let him go and marry elsewhere. I won't be ashamed of my own flesh and blood for any man in England, not I. And then Sally turned away, and burst into tears. Wait till you are 20 years older, and you will tell a different tale, replied her mother. The son stood up. Mother, he said bitterly, as I have come, so I will go. All I ask of you, is that you will allow me and mine, to lie in your stable tonight. I give you my word, that we'll be gone by break of day, and trouble you no further. Mrs. Hall, the mother, changed at that. Oh no, she answered hastily, never shall it be said, that I sent any of my own family from my door. Bring them in, Philip, or take me out to them. We will put them all into the large bedroom, said Sally, brightening, and make up a large fire. Let's go and help them in, and call Rebecca. Rebecca was the woman who assisted at the dairy and housework. She lived in a cottage hard by with her husband, who attended to the cows. Sally went to fetch a lantern from the back kitchen, but her brother said, "You won't want a light." I lit the lantern that was hanging there. "What must we call your wife?" asked Mrs. Hall. "Helena," said Philip. With shawls over their heads, they proceeded towards the back door. "One minute before you go," interrupted Philip. I haven't confessed all." "Then heaven help us," said Mrs. Hall, pushing to the door and clasping her hands in calm despair. "We passed through Ever's head as we came," he continued, "and I just looked in at the sow and acorn to see if old Mike still kept on there, as usual." The carrier had come in from Sherton Abbas at that moment, and, guessing that I was bound for this place, for I think he knew me, he asked me to bring on the dressmaker's parcel for Sally that was marked immediate. My wife had walked on with the children. 'Twas a flimsy parcel, and the paper was torn, and I found on looking at it that it was a thick warm gown. I didn't wish you to see poor Helena in a shabby state. I was ashamed that you should. 'Twas not what she was born to. I untied the parcel in the road, took it on to her, where she was waiting, in the lower barn, and told her I had managed to get it for her, and that she was to ask no question. She, poor thing, must have supposed I obtained it, on trust, through having reached a place where I was known, for she put it on gladly enough. She has it on now. Sally has other gowns, I dare say." Sally looked at her mother, speechless. "You have others, I dare say," repeated Phil, with a sick man's impatience. I thought to myself, better Sally cry than Helena freeze. "Well, is the dress of great consequence?" "'Twas nothing very ornamental, as far as I could see." "No, no, not of consequence," returned Sally sadly, adding in a gentle voice, "You will not mind if I lend her another instead of that one, will you?" Philip's agitation at the confession had brought on another attack of the cough, which seemed to shake him to pieces. He was so obviously unfit to sit in a chair that they helped him upstairs at once, and having hastily given him a cordial and kindled the bedroom fire, they descended to fetch their unhappy new relations. Chapter 3. It was with strange feelings that the girl and her mother, lately so cheerful, passed out of the back door into the open air of the barton, laden with hay scents and the herby breath of cows. A fine sleet had begun to fall, and they trotted across the yard quickly. The stable door was open. A light shone from it, from the lantern which always hung there, and which Philip had lighted, as he said. Softly nearing the door, Mrs. Hall pronounced the name, Helena. There was no answer for the moment. Looking in, she was taken by surprise. Two people appeared before her. For one, instead of the drabbish woman she had expected, Mrs. Hall saw a pale, dark-eyed, lady-like creature, whose personality ruled her attire, rather than was ruled by it. She was in a new, and handsome gown, of course, and an old bonnet. She was standing up, agitated. Her hand was held by her companion, none else than Sally's affianced, Farmer Charles Darton, upon whose fine figure the pale stranger's eyes were fixed, as his were fixed upon her. His other hand held the rein of his horse, which was standing saddled, as if just let in. At sight of Mrs. Hall they both turned, looking at her in a way neither quite conscious nor unconscious, and without seeming to recollect that words were necessary as a solution to the scene. In another moment, Sally entered also. When Mr. Darton dropped his companion's hand, led the horse aside, and came to greet his betrothed and Mrs. Hall. "Ah," he said, smiling, with something like forced composure, "this is a roundabout way of arriving, you will say, my dear Mrs. Hall. But we lost our way, which made us late. I saw a light here, and led in my horse at once. My friend John's, and my man, have gone back to the little inn with theirs, not to crowd you too much. No sooner had I entered, than I saw that this lady had taken temporary shelter here, and found I was intruding. She is my daughter-in-law," said Mrs. Hall calmly. "My son, too, is in the house, but he has gone to bed, unwell." Sally had stood staring, wonderingly, at the scene until this moment, hardly recognizing Darton's shake of the hand. The spell that bound her was broken by her perceiving the two little children seated on the heap of hay. She suddenly went forward, spoke to them, and took one on her arm and the other in her hand. "And two children," said Mr. Darton, showing thus that he had not been there long enough, as yet, to understand the situation. "My grandchildren," said Mrs. Hall, with as much affected ease as before. Philip Hall's wife, in spite of this interruption to her first rencounter, seemed scarcely so much affected by it as to feel anyone's presence, in addition to Mr. Darton's. However, arousing herself by a quick reflection, she threw a sudden critical glance of her sad eyes upon Mrs. Hall, and, apparently finding her satisfactory, advanced to her in a meek initiative. Then Sally and the stranger spoke some friendly words to each other, and Sally went on with the children into the house. Mrs. Hall and Helena followed, and Mr. Darton followed these, looking at Helena's dress and outline, and listening to her voice, like a man in a dream. By the time the others reached the house, Sally had already gone upstairs with the tired children. She rapped against the wall for Rebecca to come in, and help to attend to them, Rebecca's house being a little spit-and-dab cabin, leaning against the substantial stonework of Mrs. Hall's taller erection. When she came, a bed was made up for the little ones, and some supper given to them. On descending the stairs, after seeing this done, Sally went to the sitting room. Young Mrs. Hall entered it just in advance of her, having in the interim retired with her mother-in-law to take off her bonnet and otherwise make herself presentable. Hence it was evident that no further communication could have passed between her and Mr. Darton since their brief interview in the stable. Mr. Japheth Johns now opportunely arrived and broke up the restraint of the company after a few orthodox meteorological commentaries had passed between him and Mrs. Hall by way of introduction. They at once sat down to supper, the present of wine and turkey not being produced for consumption tonight, lest the premature display of those gifts should seem to throw doubt on Mrs. Hall's capacities as a provider. "Drink hearty, Mr. John's, drink hearty," said that matron, magnanimously. "Such as it is, there's plenty of. But perhaps cider wine is not to your taste? Though there's body in it." "Quite the contrary, ma'am, quite the contrary," said the dairyman. "For though I inherit the malt liquor principle from my father, I am a cider drinker on my mother's side. She came from these parts, you know. And there's this to be said for it, 'tis a more peaceful liquor, and don't lie about a man like your hotter drinks. With care, one may live on it a 12-month, without knocking down a neighbor or getting a black eye from an old acquaintance." The general conversation thus begun was continued briskly, though it was in the main restricted to Mrs. Hall and Japheth, who in truth required but little help from anybody. there being slight call upon Sally's tongue, she had ample leisure to do what her heart most desired, namely, watch her intended husband, and her sister-in-law, with a view of elucidating the strange momentary scene, in which her mother and herself had surprised them, in the stable. If that scene meant anything, it meant, at least, that they had met before. That there had been no time for explanations, Sally could see, for their manner was still one of suppressed amazement at each other's presence there. Darton's eyes, too, fell continually on the gown worn by Helena, as if this were an added riddle to his perplexity, though to Sally, it was the one feature in the case, which was no mystery. He seemed to feel that fate had impishly changed his vis-a-vis, in the lover's jig he was about to foot, that while the gown had been expected to enclose a Sally, a Helena's face looked out from the bodice, that some long-lost hand met his own, from the sleeves. Sally could see that, whatever Helena might know of Darton, she knew nothing of how the dress entered into his embarrassment. And, at moments the young girl would have persuaded herself that Darton's looks at her sister-in-law were entirely the fruit of the close query. But, surely at other times, a more extensive range of speculation and sentiment was expressed by her lover's eye than that which the changed dress would account for. Sally's independence made her one of the least jealous of women. But there was something in the relations of these two visitors which ought to be explained. Japheth Johns continued to converse in his well-known style, interspersing his talk with some private reflections on the position of Darton and Sally, which, though the sparkle in his eye showed them to be highly entertaining to himself, were apparently not quite communicable to the company. At last he withdrew for the night, going off to the roadside inn, half a mile back, whither Darton promised to follow him in a few minutes. Half an hour passed, and then Mr. Darton also rose to leave, Sally and her sister-in-law simultaneously wishing him good night as they retired upstairs to their rooms. But, on his arriving at the front door with Mrs. Hall, a sharp shower of rain began to come down, when the widow suggested that he should return to the fireside till the storm ceased. Darton accepted her proposal, but insisted that, as it was getting late, and she was obviously tired, she should not sit up on his account, since he could let himself out of the house, and would quite enjoy smoking a pipe by the hearth, alone. Mrs. Hall assented, and Darton was left by himself. He spread his knees to the brands, lit up his tobacco, as he had said, and sat gazing into the fire, and at the notches of the chimney crook, which hung above. An occasional drop of rain rolled down the chimney with a hiss, and still he smoked on, but not like a man whose mind was at rest. In the long run, however, despite his meditations, early hours afield, and a long ride in the open air, produced their natural result. He began to doze. How long he remained in this half-unconscious state, he did not know. He suddenly opened his eyes. The back brand had burned itself in two, and ceased to flame. The light which he had placed on the mantelpiece had nearly gone out. But, in spite of these deficiencies, there was a light in the apartment, and it came from elsewhere. Turning his head, he saw Philip Hall's wife standing at the entrance of the room, with a bed candle in one hand, a small brass tea kettle in the other, and his gown, as it certainly seemed, still upon her. "Helena," said Darton, starting up. Her countenance expressed dismay, and her first words were an apology. "I did not know you were here, Mr. Darton," she said, while a blush flashed to her cheek. "I thought everyone had retired. I was coming to make a little water boil. My husband seems to be worse. But, perhaps the kitchen fire can be lighted up again." Don't go on my account. By all means, put it on here, as you intended, said Darton. Allow me to help you. He went forward to take the kettle from her hand, but she did not allow him, and placed it on the fire herself. They stood some way apart, one on each side of the fireplace, waiting till the water should boil, the candle on the mantel between them, and Helena with her eyes on the kettle. Darton was the first to break the silence. Shall I call Sally? He said. Oh no, she quickly returned. We have given trouble enough already. We have no right here. But we are the sport of fate, and we're obliged to come. No right here, said he in surprise. None. I can't explain it now, answered Helena. This kettle is very slow. There was another pause. The proverbial dilatoriness of watched pots was never more clearly exemplified. Helena's face was of that sort, which seems to ask for assistance, without the owner's knowledge, the very antipodes of Sally's, which was self-reliance expressed. Darton's eyes traveled from the kettle to Helena's face, then back to the kettle, then to the face, for rather a longer time. So I am not to know anything of the mystery that has distracted me all the evening, he said. How is it that a woman, who refused me because, as I supposed, my position was not good enough for her taste, is found to be the wife of a man, who certainly seems to be worse off than I? He had the prior claim, said she. What, you knew him, at that time? Yes, yes. Please, say no more, she implored. Whatever my errors, I have paid for them, during the last 5 years. The heart of Darton was subject to sudden overflowings. He was kind to a fault. I am sorry, from my soul, he said, involuntarily approaching her. Helena withdrew a step or two, at which he became conscious of his movement, and quickly took his former place. Here he stood, without speaking, and the little kettle began to sing. Well, you might have been my wife, if you had chosen, he said at last. But that's all past, and gone. However, if you are in any trouble, or poverty, I shall be glad to be of service, and as your relation, by marriage, I shall have a right to be. Does your uncle know of your distress? My uncle is dead. He left me, without a farthing. And now we have 2 children to maintain. What, left you nothing? How could he be so cruel as that? I disgraced myself, in his eyes. Now, said Darton earnestly, let me take care of the children, at least while you are so unsettled. You belong to another, so I cannot take care of you. Yes, you can, said a voice, and suddenly a 3rd figure stood beside them. It was Sally. You can, since you seem to wish to, she repeated. She no longer belongs to another, my poor brother is dead. Her face was red, her eyes sparkled, and all the woman came to the front. I have heard it, she went on to him passionately. You can protect her now, as well as the children. She turned then to her agitated sister-in-law. I heard something, said Sally, in a gentle murmur, differing much from her previous passionate words, and I went into his room. It must have been the moment you left. He went off so quickly and weakly, and it was so unexpected, that I couldn't leave, even to call you. Darton was just able to gather, from the confused discourse which followed that, during his sleep by the fire, this brother, whom he had never seen, had become worse, and that during Helena's absence for water, the end had unexpectedly come. The 2 young women hastened upstairs, and he was again left alone. After standing there a short time, he went to the front door and looked out, till, softly closing it behind him, he advanced, and stood under the large sycamore tree. The stars were flickering coldly, and the dampness, which had just descended upon the earth in rain, now sent up a chill from it. Darton was in a strange position, and he felt it. The unexpected appearance and deep poverty of Helena, a young lady, daughter of a deceased naval officer, who had been brought up by her uncle, a solicitor, and had refused Darton in marriage years ago, the passionate, almost angry demeanor of Sally at discovering them, the abrupt announcement that Helena was a widow, all this coming together was a conjuncture difficult to cope with in the moment, and made him question whether he ought to leave the house, or offer assistance. But for Sally's manner, he would unhesitatingly have done the latter. He was still standing under the tree when the door in front of him opened, and Mrs. Hall came out. She went round to the garden gate at the side, without seeing him. Darton followed her, intending to speak. Pausing outside, as if in thought, she proceeded to a spot where the sun came earliest in springtime, and where the north wind never blew. It was where the row of beehives stood, under the wall. Discerning her object, he waited till she had accomplished it. It was the universal custom there about to wake the bees, by tapping at their hives, whenever a death occurred in the household, under the belief that if this were not done, the bees themselves would pine away and perish during the ensuing year. As soon as an interior buzzing responded to her tap at the first hive, Mrs. Hall went on to the second, and thus passed down the row. As soon as she came back, he met her. "What can I do in this trouble, Mrs. Hall?" he said. "Oh, nothing, thank you, nothing," she said in a tearful voice, now just perceiving him. "We have called Rebecca and her husband, and they will do everything necessary." She told him in a few words the particulars of her son's arrival, broken in health, indeed, at death's very door, though they did not suspect it, and suggested, as the result of a conversation between her and her daughter, that the wedding should be postponed. "Yes, of course," said Darton. "I think now to go straight to the inn and tell Johns what has happened." It was not till after he had shaken hands with her that he turned hesitatingly and added, "Will you tell the mother of his children that, as they are now left fatherless, I shall be glad to take the eldest of them, if it would be any convenience to her and to you?" Mrs. Hall promised that her son's widow should be told of the offer, and they parted. He retired down the rooty slope, and disappeared in the direction of the inn, where he informed Johns of the circumstances. Meanwhile Mrs. Hall had entered the house. Sally was downstairs in the sitting room alone, and her mother explained to her that Darton had readily assented to the postponement. "No doubt he has," said Sally, with sad emphasis. "It is not put off for a week, or a month, or a year. I shall never marry him, and she will." Chapter 4. Time passed, and the household on the Knapp became again serene, under the composing influences of daily routine. A desultory, very desultory correspondence dragged on between Sally Hall and Darton, who, not quite knowing how to take her petulant words, on the night of her brother's death, had continued passive thus long. Helena and her children remained at the dairy house, almost of necessity, and Darton, therefore, deemed it advisable to stay away. One day, 7 months later on, when Mr. Darton was as usual at his farm, 20 miles from Hintock, a note reached him from Helena. She thanked him for his kind offer about her children, which her mother-in-law had duly communicated, and stated that she would be glad to accept it, as regarded the eldest, the boy. Helena had, in truth, good need to do so, for her uncle had left her penniless, and all application to some relatives in the north had failed. There was, besides, as she said, no good school near Hintock to which she could send the child. On a fine summer day the boy came. He he was accompanied halfway by Sally and his mother to the White Horse at Chalk Newton, where he was handed over to Darton's bailiff in a shining spring cart, who met them there. He was entered as a day scholar at a popular school at Casterbridge, 3 or 4 miles from Darton's, having first been taught by Darton to ride a forest pony, on which he cantered to and from the aforesaid fount of knowledge, and, as Darton hoped, brought away a promising headful of the same at each diurnal expedition. The thoughtful taciturnity into which Darton had latterly fallen was quite dissipated by the presence of this boy. When the Christmas holidays came, it was arranged that he should spend them with his mother. The journey was, for some reason or other, performed in 2 stages, as at his coming, except that Darton, in person, took the place of the bailiff, and that the boy, and himself, rode on horseback. Reaching the renowned White Horse, Darton inquired if Miss and young Mrs. Hall were there, to meet little Philip, as they had agreed to be. He was answered by the appearance of Helena, alone, at the door. At the last moment, Sally would not come, she faltered. That meeting practically settled the point towards which these long-severed persons were converging. But nothing was broached about it for some time yet. Sally Hall had, in fact, imparted the first decisive motion to events by refusing to accompany Helena. She soon gave them a second move by writing the following note private. Dear Charles, living here so long, and intimately with Helena, I have naturally learned her history, especially that of it, which refers to you. I am sure she would accept you as a husband, at the proper time, and I think you ought to give her the opportunity. You inquire in an old note if I am sorry that I showed temper, which it wasn't, that night when I heard you talking to her. No, Charles, I am not sorry at all for what I said then. Yours sincerely, Sally Hall. Thus set in train, the transfer of Darton's heart back to its original quarters proceeded by mere lapse of time. In the following July, Darton went to his friend Japheth to ask him at last to fulfill the bridal office which had been in abeyance since the previous January, 12 months. With all my heart, man o' constancy, said Dairyman Johns warmly. I've lost most of my genteel fair complexion, haymaking this hot weather, 'tis true, but I'll do your business as well as them that look better. There be sense and good hair oil in the world yet, thank God, and they'll take off the roughest o' my edge. I'll compliment her. Better late than never, Sally Hall, I'll say. It is not Sally, said Darton hurriedly. It is young Mrs. Hall. Japheth's face, as soon as he really comprehended, became a picture of reproachful dismay. Not Sally, he said. Why not Sally? I can't believe it. Young Mrs. Hall. Well, where's your wisdom? Darton shortly explained particulars, but Johns would not be reconciled. She was a woman worth having, if ever woman was, he cried. And now, to let her go. But I suppose I can marry where I like, said Darton. H'M, replied the dairyman, lifting his eyebrows expressively. This don't become you, Charles, it really do not. If I had done such a thing, you would have sworn I was a cursed northern fool, to be drawn off the scent by such a red herring doll. Farmer Darton responded in such sharp terms to this laconic opinion that the two friends finally parted in a way they had never parted before. Johns was to be no groomsman to Darton, after all. He had flatly declined. Darton went off sorry and even unhappy, particularly as Japheth was about to leave that side of the county, so that the words which had divided them were not likely to be explained away or softened down. A short time after the interview, Darton was united to Helena at a simple matter-of-fact wedding, and she, and her little girl, joined the boy who had already grown, to look on Darton's house as home. For some months, the farmer experienced an unprecedented happiness and satisfaction. There had been a flaw in his life, and it was as neatly mended as was humanly possible. But, after a season, the stream of events followed less clearly, and there were shades in his reveries. Helena was a fragile woman, of little staying power, physically or morally, and since the time that he had originally known her, 8 or 10 years before, she had been severely tried. She had loved herself out, in short, and was now occasionally given to moping. Sometimes she spoke regretfully of the gentilities of her early life, and instead of comparing her present state with her condition as the wife of the unlucky Hall, she mused rather on what it had been before she took the first fatal step of clandestinely marrying him. She did not care to please such people as those with whom she was thrown as a thriving farmer's wife. She allowed the pretty trifles of agricultural domesticity to glide by her as sorry details, and had it not been for the children, Darton's house would have seemed but little brighter than it had been before. This led to occasional unpleasantness, until Darton sometimes declared to himself that such endeavors as his to rectify early deviations of the heart, by harking back to the old point, mostly failed of success. "Perhaps Johns was right," he would say. "I should have gone on with Sally. Better go with the tide, and make the best of its course, than stem it at the risk of a capsize." But he kept these unmelodious thoughts to himself, and was outwardly considerate and kind. This somewhat barren tract of his life had extended to less than a year and a half, when his ponderings were cut short by the loss of the woman they concerned. When she was in her grave, he thought better of her than when she had been alive. The farm was a worse place without her than with her, after all. No woman short of divine could have gone through such an experience as hers with her first husband without becoming a little soured. Her stagnant sympathies, her sometimes unreasonable manner, had covered a heart frank and well-meaning and originally hopeful and warm. She left him a tiny red infant in white wrappings. To make life as easy as possible to this touching object became at once his care. As this child learned to walk and talk, Darton learned to see feasibility in a scheme which pleased him. Revolving the experiment which he had hitherto made upon life, he fancied he had gained wisdom from his mistakes and caution from his miscarriages. What the scheme was needs no penetration to discover. Once more, he had opportunity to recast and rectify his ill-wrought situations by returning to Sally Hall, who still lived quietly on, under her mother's roof at Hintock. Helena had been the woman to lend pathos and refinement to a home. Sally was the woman to brighten it. She would not, as Helena did, despise the rural simplicities of a farmer's fireside. Moreover, she had a preeminent qualification for Darton's household. No other woman could make so desirable a mother to her brother's two children and Darton's one as Sally, while Darton, now that Helena had gone, was a more promising husband for Sally than he had ever been when liable to reminders from an uncured sentimental wound. Darton was not a man to act rapidly, and the working out of his reparative designs might have been delayed for some time. But there came a winter evening, precisely like the one which had darkened over that former ride to Hintock, and he asked himself why he should postpone longer when the very landscape called for a repetition of that attempt. He told his man to saddle the mare, booted and spurred himself with a younger horseman's nicety, kissed the two youngest children, and rode off. to make the journey a complete parallel to the first, he would fain have had his old acquaintance Japheth Johns with him. But Johns, alas, was missing. His removal to the other side of the county had left unrepaired the breach which had arisen between him and Darton, and though Darton had forgiven him 100 times, as Johns had probably forgiven Darton, the effort of reunion, in present circumstances, was one not likely to be made. He screwed himself up to as cheerful a pitch as he could, without his former crony, and became content with his own thoughts as he rode, instead of the words of a companion. The sun went down, the boughs appeared scratched in, like an etching against the sky. Old crooked men, with faggots at their backs, said good night, sir, and Darton replied good night, right heartily. By the time he reached the forking roads, it was getting as dark as it had been on the occasion when Johns climbed the directing post. Darton made no mistake this time. Nor shall I be able to mistake, thank heaven, when I arrive, he murmured. It gave him peculiar satisfaction to think that the proposed marriage, like his first, was of the nature of setting in order things long awry, and not a momentary freak of fancy. Nothing hindered the smoothness of his journey, which seemed not half its former length. Though dark, it was only between 5 and 6 o'clock, when the bulky chimneys of Mrs. Hall's residence appeared in view, behind the sycamore tree. On second thoughts, he retreated and put up at the alehouse, as in former time, and when he had plumed himself before the inn mirror, called for something to drink, and smoothed out the incipient wrinkles of care, he walked on to the Knap with a quick step. Chapter 5. That evening Sally was making pinners for the milkers, who were now increased by 2, for her mother and herself no longer joined in milking the cows themselves. But, upon the whole, there was little change in the household economy, and not much in its appearance, beyond such minor particulars as that the crack over the window, which had been 100 years coming, was a trifle wider, that the beams were a shade blacker, that the influence of modernism had supplanted the open chimney corner by a grate, that Rebecca, who had worn a cap when she had plenty of hair, had left it off, now she had scarce any, because it was reported that caps were not fashionable, and that Sally's face had naturally assumed a more womanly and experienced cast. Mrs. Hall was actually lifting coals with the tongs, as she had used to do. 5 years ago this very night, if I am not mistaken, apostrophe she said, laying on an ember. Not this very night, though it was one night this week, said the correct Sally. Well, 'tis near enough. 5 years ago Mr. Darton came to marry you, and my poor boy Phil came home to die. She sighed. Ah, Sally, she presently said, if you had managed well, Mr. Darton would have had you, Helen or none. Don't be sentimental about that, Mother, begged Sally. I didn't care to manage well in such a case. Though I liked him, I wasn't so anxious. I would never have married the man in the midst of such a hitch as that was, she added with decision, and I don't think I would if he were to ask me now. I am not sure about that, unless you have another in your eye. I wouldn't, and I'll tell you why. I could hardly marry him for love at this time o' day. And as we've quite enough to live on, if we give up the dairy tomorrow, I should have no need to marry for any meaner reason. I am quite happy enough as I am, and there's an end of it. Now it was not long after this dialogue that there came a mild rap at the door, and in a moment there entered Rebecca, looking as though a ghost had arrived. The fact was that accomplished skimmer and churner, now a resident in the house, had overheard the desultory observations between mother and daughter, and on opening the door to Mr. Darton, thought the coincidence must have a grisly meaning in it. Mrs. Hall welcomed the farmer with warm surprise, as did Sally, and for a moment they rather wanted words. "Can you push up the chimney crook for me, Mr. Darton? The notches hitch," said the matron. He did it, and the homely little act bridged over the awkward consciousness that he had been a stranger for 4 years. Mrs. Hall soon saw what he had come for, and left the principals together while she went to prepare him a late tea, smiling at Sally's recent hasty assertions of indifference when she saw how civil Sally was. When tea was ready, she joined them. She fancied that Darton did not look so confident as when he had arrived, but Sally was quite light-hearted, and the meal passed pleasantly. About 7 he took his leave of them. Mrs. Hall went as far as the door to light him down the slope. On the doorstep he said frankly, "I came to ask your daughter to marry me. Chose the night and everything, with an eye to a favorable answer. But she won't." "Then she's a very ungrateful girl," emphatically said Mrs. Hall. Darton paused to shape his sentence, and asked, I suppose there's nobody else more favored?" "I can't say that there is, or that there isn't," answered Mrs. Hall. "She's private in some things. I'm on your side, however, Mr. Darton, and I'll talk to her." Thank ye, said the farmer in a gayer accent, and with this assurance, the not very satisfactory visit came to an end. Darton descended the roots of the sycamore, the light was withdrawn, and the door closed. At the bottom of the slope, he nearly ran against a man about to ascend. Can a jack-o'-lent believe his few senses on such a dark night, or can't he? Exclaimed one, whose utterance Darton recognized in a moment, despite its unexpectedness. "I dare not swear he can, though I fain would." The speaker was Johns. Darton said he was glad of this opportunity, bad as it was, of putting an end to the silence of years, and asked the dairyman what he was traveling that way for. Japheth showed the old jovial confidence in a moment. "I'm going to see your relations as they always seem to me," he said, "Mrs. Hall and Sally." "Well, Charles, the fact is I find the natural barbarousness of man is much increased by a bachelor life, and, as your leavings were always good enough for me, I'm trying civilization here." He nodded towards the house. "Not with Sally to marry her?" said Darton, feeling something like a rill of ice water between his shoulders. "Yes, by the help of Providence and my personal charms. And I think I shall get her. I am this road every week, my present dairy is only 4 miles off, you know, and I see her through the window. 'Tis rather odd that I was going to speak practical tonight to her for the first time." "You've just called?" "Yes, for a short while. But she didn't say a word about you." "A good sign, a good sign. Now, that decides me. I'll swing the mallet and get her answer this very night as I planned." A few more remarks, and Darton, wishing his friend joy of Sally, in a slightly hollow tone of jocularity, bade him goodbye. Johns promised to write particulars, and ascended, and was lost in the shade of the house and tree. A rectangle of light appeared when Johns was admitted, and all was dark again. "Happy Japheth," said Darton. "This then is the explanation." He determined to return home that night. In a quarter of an hour, he passed out of the village, and the next day went about his sweet lifting and storing as if nothing had occurred. He waited and waited to hear from Johns whether the wedding day was fixed, but no letter came. He learned not a single particular till, meeting Johns one day at a horse auction, Darton exclaimed genially, rather more genially than he felt, "When is the joyful day to be?" To his great surprise, a reciprocity of gladness was not conspicuous in John's. "Not at all," he said, in a very subdued tone. "'Tis a bad job. She won't have me." Darton held his breath, till he said with treacherous solicitude, "Try again, his coyness." "Oh no," said Johns decisively. "There's been none of that. We talked it over dozens of times, in the most fair and square way. She tells me plainly, I don't suit her. 'Twould be simply annoying her, to ask her again." "Ah, Charles, you threw a prize away, when you let her slip 5 years ago."
I did,
said Darton. He returned from that auction, with a new set of feelings in play. He had certainly made a surprising mistake, in thinking John's his successful rival. It really seemed, as if he might hope for Sally after all. This time, being rather pressed by business, Darton had recourse to pen and ink, and wrote her as manly and straightforward a proposal as any woman could wish to receive. The reply came promptly. "Dear Mr. Darton, I am as sensible as any woman can be of the goodness that leads you to make me this offer a second time. Better women than I would be proud of the honor, for when I read your nice long speeches on mangold wurzel and such like topics at the Casterbridge Farmers Club, I do feel it an honor, I assure you. But my answer is just the same as before. I will not try to explain what, in truth, I cannot explain my reasons. I will simply say that I must decline to be married to you. With good wishes, as in former times, I am, your faithful friend, Sally Hall." Darton dropped the letter hopelessly. Beyond the negative, there was just a possibility of sarcasm in it. Nice long speeches on mangold wurzel had a suspicious sound. However, sarcasm or none, there was the answer, and he had to be content. He proceeded to seek relief in a business which at this time engrossed much of his attention, that of clearing up a curious mistake, just current in the county, that he had been nearly ruined by the recent failure of a local bank. A farmer named Darton had lost heavily, and the similarity of name had probably led to the error. Belief in it was so persistent that it demanded several days of letter writing to set matters straight and persuade the world that he was as solvent as ever he had been in his life. He had hardly concluded this worrying task when, to his delight, another letter arrived in the handwriting of Sally. Darton tore it open. It was very short. "Dear Mr. Darton, we have been so alarmed these last few days by the report that you were ruined by the stoppage of Foo's bank, that, now it is contradicted, I hasten, by my mother's wish, to say how truly glad we are to find there is no foundation for the report. After your kindness to my poor brother's children, I can do no less than write at such a moment. We had a letter from each of them a few days ago. Your faithful friend, Sally Hall." "Mercenary little woman," said Darton to himself, with a smile. Then that was the secret of her refusal this time. She thought I was ruined. Now, such was Darton, that as hours went on, he could not help feeling too generously towards Sally to condemn her in this. What did he want in a wife, he asked himself? Love and integrity. What next? Worldly wisdom. And was there really more than worldly wisdom in her refusal to go aboard a sinking ship? She now knew it was otherwise. "Begad," he said, "I'll try her again." The fact was he had so set his heart upon Sally, and Sally alone, that nothing was to be allowed to balk him, and his reasoning was purely formal. Anniversaries having been unpropitious, he waited until a bright day late in May, a day when all animate nature was fancying, in its trusting, foolish way, that it was going to bask out of doors forevermore. As he rode through Long Ash Lane, it was scarce recognizable as the track of his two winter journeys. No mistake could be made now, even with his eyes shut. The cuckoo's note was at its best, between April tentativeness and midsummer decrepitude, and the reptiles in the sun behaved as winningly as kittens on the hearth. Though afternoon, and about the same time as on the last occasion, it was broad day and sunshine when he entered Hintock, and the details of the Knapdairy house were visible far up the road. He saw Sally in the garden, and was set vibrating. He at first intended to go on to the inn, but no, he said, I'll tie my horse to the garden gate. If all goes well, it can soon be taken round. If not, I mount and ride away. The tall shade of the horseman darkened the room in which Mrs. Hall sat, and made her start, for he had ridden by a side path to the top of the slope, where riders seldom came. In a few seconds, he was in the garden with Sally. 3 minutes did the business at the back of that row of bees. Though spring had come, and heavenly blue consecrated the scene, Darton succeeded not. No, said Sally firmly. I will never, never marry you, Mr. Darton. I would have done it once, but now, I never can. But, implored Mr. Darton, and with a burst of real eloquence, he went on to declare all sorts of things that he would do for her. He would drive her to see her mother every week, take her to London, settle so much money upon her, heaven knows what he did not promise, suggest, and tempt her with. But it availed nothing. She interposed with a stout negative, which closed the course of his argument, like an iron gate across a highway. Darton paused. Then, said he simply, you hadn't heard of my supposed failure when you declined last time. I had not, she said. But if I had, 'twould have been all the same. And 'tis not because of any soreness from my slighting you years ago? No. That soreness is long past. Ah, then you despise me, Sally? No, she slowly answered. I don't altogether despise you. I don't think you quite such a hero as I once did, that's all. The truth is, I am happy enough as I am, and I don't mean to marry at all. Now, may I ask a favor, sir? She spoke with an ineffable charm, which, whenever he thought of it, made him curse his loss of her as long as he lived. To any extent, please, do not put this question to me any more. Friends, as long as you like, but lovers, and married, never. I never will, said Darton. Not if I live 100 years. And he never did. That he had worn out his welcome in her heart was only too plain. When his stepchildren had grown up and were placed out in life, all communication between Darton and the Hall family ceased. It was only by chance that, years after, he learned that Sally, notwithstanding the solicitations her attractions drew down upon her, had refused several offers of marriage, and steadily adhered to her purpose of leading a single life. End of story.